Good afternoon and welcome to the April program of Senior Statesmen of Virginia. My name is Jeff Gould and I'm president. We are celebrating Senior Statesmen, our 25th anniversary this year. And we are delighted to be able to bring programs on a monthly basis to our community of interest and import. And we will be continuing to do that for some months and years ahead, we hope. Just a little housekeeping first. You, the audience, will be muted throughout this presentation. When our speakers have finished their initial presentations, then you may submit questions by clicking on the Q&A at the bottom of your screen. So let me go ahead and introduce our speakers today. Our first speaker is Rebecca Kendall, and she is the director of the Community Mental Health and Wellness Coalition. She has a master's degree in social work and over two decades of leadership experience in community health. She is passionate about promoting health equity and building effective collaborations to improve mental health and wellness in our community. Lisa Bites is Executive Director of Region 10 Community Services Board. Lisa is a doctoral candidate in social work. She holds presently a master's in social work and is an LCSW, licensed clinical social worker. Lisa has worked for 29 years with vulnerable people in our community. Lisa believes that there, but for the grace of God, go I. We are all vulnerable to experiences of behavioral health challenges, as we must embrace other people's struggles as if they were our own. So let's begin this afternoon with Rebecca. Rebecca?
Great, thank you, Jeff. I forgot to warn my kiddos that they shouldn't interrupt me, my big kids, so they can handle it, but I just had to mute for a few thumps down the stairs. So one of the big challenges of the COVID era and parenting. So I am sharing my screen. I want to make sure everyone can see that. So thanks for having us. I am the director of the Community Mental Health and Wellness Coalition. And for those of you that don't know about the coalition, we work in the same footprint as the Region 10 catchment area. And Region 10 is our fiscal agent. And our mission is collaborating to promote behavioral health and wellness through planning, advocacy, and access to effective service delivery. So we do not provide direct services ourselves, but work with the safety net providers in our region to help coordinate more seamless systems and to respond to emerging mental health issues. These are our member organizations. And you can see they include healthcare providers, criminal justice sector, nonprofits. And when I say we respond to emerging mental health issues, COVID has been one of those and in a significant way. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're seeing across the region around the impact of behavioral health on COVID, and then some services that have emerged in response to COVID. But before getting started, I just wanted to provide a framework for how I think about community health. Research shows that health outcomes, and when I say health, mental health is a critical part of health. There is no health without mental health. Health outcomes are more impacted by the places where we live, work, and play than by our genetics, and then by our health behaviors. There are factors in our community environments that shape long-term health outcomes in a way that is really significant. And they're called the social determinants of health. And so again, I use this framework when I think about mental health, the social determinants of mental health. And so these are just a few of those social determinants of mental health. And when you look at these are all things that impact poor mental health or create a risk for mental illness. And all of these things, or many of these things at least, have been directly impacted by the pandemic. So people have been underemployed or have been forced to leave the workforce altogether, maybe for childcare, have lost jobs, food insecurity has been on the rise, healthcare, the whole health system is impacted. People had to delay elective surgeries, or maybe were afraid to go to the emergency room. Children's education is impacted by virtual schooling. People have been struggling financially. Down here in the lower left-hand corner, social isolation. It's a huge, huge, huge factor that is infecting all of us during the pandemic. And then for little ones, adverse early life experiences. This is a very, very stressful time. And we know that when children are exposed to early chronic stressors, that it can actually impact their brain development. Luckily, that's not permanent. And there's lots of things that we can do to build resilience. But all of these factors have been affected by COVID. So early on in COVID, the CDC did research surveys to help understand the impact of COVID on mental health. And they found that a third of Americans were experiencing anxiety and depression symptoms, a quarter experiencing trauma and trauma-related stress reactions. There was an increase in substance misuse and an increase in suicide ideation. So for anxiety and depression, it was three times more than the same time period in 2019. And for trauma and stress injuries, four times more than the same time period. So we have all been affected by COVID. Some groups and communities have been more affected. People who experienced income loss generally had greater mental health impact. Families of color in general had greater impacts. Women and caregivers, particularly caregivers who are in that sandwich generation where they're caring for young kids but might have older parents that they were concerned about. And then 18 to 24-year-olds and essential workers are some of the groups that have been most impacted according to the data and also what we have seen locally with our member organizations. So I wanted to share a little snapshot of what the data is showing for the impact of COVID on substance use. So here we can see the light blue dotted line is how much alcohol is sold in retail environments, so grocery stores. The bottom line is how much alcohol is sold in retail environments, such as restaurants, et cetera. You can see that line actually dropped with stay-at-home orders and social distancing. But you can see that beginning in April 2020, alcohol consumption rose significantly over the baseline in 2019. The flip side of that, this is data from the Department of Behavioral Health, is that more people have initiated substance use disorder services. So that's the good news, that people have been reaching out for services. So COVID has been a time where people have been reflecting on what is most meaningful and important to them in their lives. It might be a time when people are thinking about changes they may need to make, or family members may be encouraging people to seek help more than when people aren't all under the same roof to the same degree as we've been. So there has been an increase in initiation of services for substance use disorders. You may have heard in the news that related to this, that 2020 was the biggest year for overdose really ever. And this is a graph of emergency department visits for overdose. And you can see this is for all drugs, but the graphs for opioids, prescription opioids, and for heroin are pretty similar, where they have general, you can see this top line is the Region 10 catchment area. This line is Virginia. They've dropped for a number of years from 2015 onward, and then increase again in 2020. And so that is a concern. 2020 has shown really significant increase in opioid overdose, methamphetamine overdose, fentanyl overdose. And so these are things that we continue to work on as a community and we'll be addressing into the future. Community providers really needed to pivot quickly in their response to COVID. So psychotherapists, counselors, peer support specialists, these are really relational. It's a relational workforce. People work face-to-face, and the pivot to telehealth that was required for mental health providers was really significant. It needed to happen fast. People were in acute crisis when the stay-at-home orders came down in March of 2020, and people still needed care, and more people needed more acute care. So this was a headline that I found that the pivot to telehealth was called the fastest in mental health history. And it really is quite amazing how quickly local providers needed to change their way of practicing and began using Zoom as a primary platform, or WebEx or some other virtual platform as the primary way for meeting with clients. It has been really interesting journey for providers and for clients. And in some ways, it has increased access. So people who have in the past had transportation barriers and couldn't drive to get in, maybe had childcare issues. Zoom has been a blessing. It's made it easier to be able to connect with services. For people with broadband access issues, that's been challenging. Some people, dealing with the technology learning curve has been significant. But telehealth is going to be here to stay. I think that in the years to come, in some ways, this will be a blessing, that this is another tool that the mental health workforce will have in our tool belt. Two different services that I just wanted to let you all know that have sprouted up across the state during COVID. The Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services has launched a warm line in conjunction with Mental Health America. So it's called the VA COPES line. That's this graphic down here on the left-hand side. So the warm line is available 7 days a week for someone to pick up the phone, be able to talk about isolation, struggles with COVID, frustrations with homeschooling, concerns about financial security, and they will also help people connect to care in their home communities. So they have Spanish-speaking counselors. Again, it's 7 days a week, and there's a trained counselor on the other end of the line. Another key service that I think is really helpful for people to know about, this is particular for essential workers, is the Virginia Community Response Network is providing free trauma support to essential workers. And so that's defined really broadly. That includes healthcare workers. It includes grocery store workers, delivery workers, people who are working in high-risk environments that may need a little additional support. And this service is free. This was really important in the beginning. You know, now staff are beginning to get vaccinated. And I think a lot of the workforce is still feels a little skittish about getting back to work. People are also very eager to get back to work, but many people never left the workforce. And these kinds of services were really helpful along the way. One of the things the coalition has been doing is really helping to promote awareness about local services in our catchment areas, as well as information about the five core needs during times of stress. So the research shows that during times of community crisis, there are five key human needs. And those are to stay safe. So that means, you know, helping people on your work site have the proper PPE and feel like they know the policies and procedures for maintaining safety. Or that might mean, you know, early on it was people feeling like they knew how to go to the grocery store and feel safe. Another one of the key human needs are creating calm. And that looks very different to everybody. Everybody has different ways of calming. It can be a walk outside. It could be singing. It can be playing with your dog. But reminding people to actually schedule time in their day to do calming activities is really important. Staying connected has taken on a whole new meaning in this world. And so we just encourage people to stay connected, whether it's virtually or outdoors, safely, to stay connected with others. Building a can-do spirit is developing routines and problem solving to know that you can make it through. We have a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel with COVID now, but early on, building kind of a sense in that of confidence and can-do spirit was really, really important. And then maintaining hope is another one of those five core needs. So being able to believe in the future, focus on things that make you feel hopeful and confident about the future. One of the things another thing the coalition has been doing, we've been working with Region 10's prevention program and with Lock and Talk Virginia to help distribute medication lock boxes and lock bags and trigger locks, because we know opioid overdoses have increased and deaths by suicide have also been on the rise across the nation. And these are free safety devices that we are giving out to community members who need them so that they can lock firearms and lock medication to help keep their families safe. So we have a sign-up form that individuals can request those devices at region10.org/doyourpart. And really just trying to get those out into the community. And I'll just end by encouraging folks, if you want to stay in touch, we have a monthly newsletter, electronic newsletter that comes out. I'll send my slides to Jeff to be able to get out to folks afterwards, if that's possible. I'll also drop my email in the chat, and you can let me know if you're interested in signing up for our newsletter, which is chock full of mental health and substance use resources in the community.
Thank you, Rebecca. We turn now to Lisa. It's all yours.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Lisa Bites. I really appreciate being with you all today and talking about behavioral health in the COVID environment. I'm going to want to start first with talking about what Region 10 does as a community services board, so we have a bit of framework for the conversation. Region 10 is a public quasi-governmental entity that depends on federal, state, local funding, third-party payer, donations, and grants. And we work with the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services, DBHDS, through a performance contract, which allows for funding, data reporting, and performance expectations and standards. Region 10 is one of 40 CSBs, really 39 CSBs, and a behavioral health authority that is across Virginia, and the CSBs serve every locality in Virginia. CSBs are part of Code of Virginia, and what that means is that we are required by law to be available and responsive 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to assess people who are experiencing a psychiatric emergency for involuntary hospitalization. We are also required to offer case management services for folks with developmental disabilities, mental health, or substance use disorders as funds allow. Everything else that Region 10 does, and I won't talk about all of it, but I'll offer some scope of our work, is based on conversation, information, and partnership with the communities that we serve to identify needs and gaps in services. And then when we have funds to do so, we develop programs and services to fill those gaps. Region 10 serves six localities, Charlottesville, as well as the counties of Albemarle, Louisa, Nelson, Fluvanna, and Greene. We serve about 10,000 people a year through those six localities. Region 10 provides services across the lifespan for folks who have a developmental disability, a mental illness, or a substance use disorder, and would benefit from our services. I think it's noteworthy that Region 10 has more than 40 programs. We have 30 program sites or residential facilities, and we have more than 550 staff who do this work every day. The services that we provide are not all provided in all of our locations, if that makes sense. But a bit of the services we do provide in the as community-based includes outpatient services or case management services. We provide community-based groups for substance use disorders and mental health challenges. And we also have group homes for folks with developmental disabilities and mental illness. And then we have three different stabilization programs, one to help divert psychiatric hospitalization, and then two for people who have substance use disorders that require patient treatment. I think that we were tasked a bit with talking about COVID, and I want to start by saying we have a few local trends that began prior to COVID, but certainly are exacerbated by the global pandemic. Our greatest risk is the psychiatric hospital bed census crisis. And what that means is that we have about 35 private psychiatric hospitals across Virginia and 9 state psychiatric facilities. And for people who are experiencing a psychiatric emergency who can't keep themselves safe or can't be safe around others, they need a locked psychiatric hospital to help stabilize that crisis and help them integrate back into the community with safety. One of the reasons we have the state psychiatric crisis is that over the last 15 years, we have a reduction of over 200 beds across the state that are available for people with a psychiatric emergency. And in 2014, there was new legislation that required that if there was somebody who was in crisis and needed hospitalization involuntarily, and there wasn't a private psychiatric hospital bed, that the state hospitals could not refuse to admit them, which changed the dynamic and how everyone worked together in the system, but also really the mission and purpose of state psychiatric facilities. Since that time, state psychiatric facilities have seen 146% increase in bed utilization. And what is also true across our catchment area in Region 10 is we've seen an increase in crisis contacts. And what that means is somebody may call and say, I'm having a hard time. I need to talk with somebody. Gosh, I think I need some help. And we will assess by phone if we need to see them in person and assess whether they need to go to the hospital. And if so, we'll meet them in the emergency department or in our office and determine whether they need to go to the hospital. Our numbers have not increased as dramatically as the statewide numbers, but what is true is that the acuity of the symptoms that our people are coming in with is much, much greater over time. And then again, during COVID, and we'll talk a little bit about some of that. Part of the challenge with connecting people to service in a global pandemic is that COVID testing has become part of the admissions process to determine whether someone can come to a hospital or a group home or any other inpatient setting. Needing a negative test result has become standard of practice. And as you all know, that testing, especially early on, was hard to come by. It's also true that people are getting sick. So we've had some positive test results in the people we serve and had to divert them from services, but our staff have gotten sick as well. And so between those two challenges, it has decreased our capacity to serve people. The economy has created complications systemically. So Rebecca talked individually. We'll talk a little bit about that a little bit later. But systemically, what that has meant is through COVID, with the economic challenges, the community infrastructure that provides services and supports to people that keep them in the community and from needing hospitalization have closed. And so there are less resources to support people, which means that more and more people have to go to the hospital because there aren't other resources that keep them safe in the community. And so I would say that one of the things that has happened for Region 10 is that we are lucky, and I don't know who's in our audience, but I'd like to say we are lucky to have a partnership with the Blue Ridge Health District, who has really been a strong partner in making sure that Region 10 staff who are eligible and Region 10 consumers who are eligible have ability to get a vaccine, which allows us to work safely and face-to-face as needed through the pandemic in a way that keeps people healthy. So what's true across the nation is also true in our local communities. We're seeing people who are reeling from the national news and experiencing some post-traumatic stress symptoms based on their own lived experience. And so as we are all home all the time, and we are all inundated with what's going on around us through the news media, no matter where you sit and what you see, it creates stress and a challenge in terms of turning it off and separating, which is a bit of what Rebecca referred to in terms of how to keep yourself healthy, which is how do you disconnect from the things that create stress and create safe space so that you stay balanced. But we're seeing folks who are having PTSD symptoms from the national experience right now. There are multiple stressors that are combined with individual challenge, such as being sick, worrying about becoming sick with COVID, or a loved one who has an underlying health condition, furloughs and layoffs, and then the lack of in-person schooling. I think Rebecca started her talk with having children, you know, in her talk, and she's able to roll with that. But it is not without stress to become a teacher as well as a parent, as well as, you know, a professional all at the same time all day long. And then there's the social isolation piece. We're seeing that within our catchment area as well. The isolation that if someone is, it increases depression and anxiety, and then the substance abuse. We're seeing more domestic violence and child abuse as well. I will say that in the last year or during the pandemic, Region 10 has seen a 51% increase in adult outpatient services and an 800% increase in mental health group services. Some of that's connected to the pandemic and people needing to connect any way that they can and knowing that their wellness and balance is about having some services and support available to them when they need it. And some of it really is about that telehealth piece of things. So Region 10 did pivot along with everyone else. Within a week, we went from primarily in person to primarily telehealth. And for us, that meant telephone, Zoom, and in-person is clinically indicated. And what we have seen is that our pockets of our consumer population really prefer telehealth first. And second, we've seen a significant decrease in no-shows and cancellations. People are picking up their phone, they're engaging in services at a higher rate, and that's a real positive. For children, we're seeing a 23% increase in outpatient services and an 888% increase in family therapy. So, you know, that piece of being challenged by being a parent with a child at home all day means that for some of our clinicians, we're able to see the whole family system. And that is a real strength because from a family systems perspective, you want to work with all the people who live in a home together to create health for the system. In terms of substance abuse, we're seeing a 62% increase in referrals to our substance abuse residential and outpatient services. And we're seeing the relapse trends that Rebecca talked about the increase in purchases, the alcohol. What we're seeing is that people who have maintained sobriety for some period of time are relapsing. They're starting to use again. And then last but not least, I think I'm close to the end of my time. We've provided face-to-face crisis response to almost 3,500 people through this last year and hospitalized 776 psychiatrically, which is about 22%. And again, that's not a much greater number than we've had historically. What it is we're the combination of higher acuity by the time someone connects to our emergency services response and the lack of other community infrastructure to keep people in the community is a real challenge for us. The pandemic opportunity, moving to a primarily telehealth platform has done just what Rebecca said for Region 10, which is transportation and childcare have not been as great issues. What is also true is because we are across six localities, people typically went to the clinic within their county. So if you live in Nelson County, you go to the Nelson Counseling Center. What is true for us is we can connect someone in Nelson County to a clinician who works out of our Peterson building in town. So the barrier of connecting to people to resources has actually decreased through the environment with the use of telehealth. And so what we've been doing around that at Region 10 is we've been reimagining services in a go forward to keep, you know, we're going to keep safety at the forefront. And we're certainly going to want to see people in person, face to face, as clinically indicated. Sometimes you can only know how a person is doing when you sit with them in the same room. At the same time, we hope to offer the people who need services more flexibility in how they connect to services through the use of telehealth. And then last but not least, what do we see in the future? You know, our immediate work is to continue to be a stabilizing force for individuals in our communities, partner with other community agencies around responding to what's happening for people in real time in a way that is positive and increases quality of life. We're seeing more and more regional initiatives coming to the CSBs from the department, our state department. And so Region 10 partners with the other CSBs that are in our region to begin to build out a more robust continuum of care across our region. And what that means is we're looking at mobile crisis response, 23-hour bed opportunities, other ways that we can help people stay in the community. And then last but not least, I could talk all day about our workforce challenges. That's a different talk. What we imagine for the future at Region 10 is to continue to seek creative ways to develop the next generation of passionate and equipped community behavioral health professionals who really understand what it is to walk with a person in their journey for recovery. And so we have tremendous staff who do that now, but it would be remiss of Region 10 to not to look to the future to see how we can be sure that the next generation of behavioral health professionals is on the way. And Jeff, I think that's it for me. Thank you. I'm going to stop sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've had a question come in already. I think this would be for Rebecca. And that is, how does one sign up for your newsletter? We've got no volume.
Sorry, I said I was going to put that in the chat, and I was so busy listening to Lisa, I forgot. I'll put the sign up link in the chat for people, and also my email if people need it.
Okay, thank you. One of the things that I heard Lisa talk about was that Region 10 currently has some 550 employees. Has that expanded or because of COVID or shrunk in some way?
It has shrunk. We early in COVID, we made very difficult decisions around staffing and furloughed or laid off almost a third of our staff. And we were able to bring all of our furloughed staff back, but we're smaller than we were.
And that's really an amazing fact that Region 10 is in effect one of the larger employers in our entire district. And people don't realize that it is a big business, let alone all the services you provide.
Our goal is to be woven into the fabric of the communities we serve.
I wanted to follow that up with a question about funding. You had a graph about where your funding comes from, Lisa, and then I'll ask Rebecca too, but has the COVID impacted your funding or your revenue streams?
So yes, when we pivoted from in-person to telehealth services, our daily revenue through third-party payers is a tenth of what it was pre-COVID. And what we have done over time is stabilize that from our third-party payers. What is also true, so that's sort of the first piece. The second piece is that the department, DBHDS, has been working on with CSBs, STEP Virginia, and I'm gonna say service transformation excellence and in programming. I might have gotten that just a bit wrong. STEP Virginia, and in each step, standardizing best practices across all 40 CSBs, and there's some new funding coming in to support that initiative. It's not so much COVID related, but it has been shaped by our what's going on in our nation and the timing of the funding is connected to really seeing behavioral health as a addressing behavioral health as a necessary component to overall health, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Lisa. Rebecca, what about your funding? I know that the coalition was started through a grant from CICF.
We have diversified funding, like most nonprofit organizations, where we receive money from partnerships with the city and Albemarle County. We are drawing down some federal funds for opioid coalition work. And I think that really it hasn't really changed during COVID, but I think that our local government partners are recognizing more and more the key role of a coalition to pull together partners during these changing times, and that's really critical with as much upheaval as COVID has created.
We've had another question come in asking about how services from your two areas impact or provide services to the public schools in our area. Rebecca, you want to try that first, and then we'll switch over to Lisa.
Sure. I work closely with the Region 10 prevention team that does a lot of the work in the local schools. So in Charlottesville and Albemarle County, there are student assistance specialists that work in many of the middle schools and high schools. They do positive youth development, substance use prevention, and mental health promotion and mental health early identification counseling in the schools. The coalition itself doesn't work in the schools, but again, we work with those partners and help with communications to schools and parents.
I just have a quick reminder for our audience before we turn to Lisa on that question. And that is, would you please use the Q&A function and not the chat to send questions in? Q&A and not the chat. Lisa.
So yes, we do the SAPs in town. We also have a crisis interventionist in our Louisa County schools. That's in partnership in response to a request from the schools. And we are able to and willing to connect around emergency services. But what I would say about that, is that's the scope of the active involvement in the schools, if you will, like actually having Region 10 staff in the schools. And of course, the schools refer to us for services as is appropriate.
Thank you, Lisa. Have there been or will there be any impact for either of the agencies from new laws that have just recently been passed by the General Assembly? Are there improvements? Do you see that as have they had positive actions this year or not so? Rebecca, you want to try that?
Well, a lot happened in the assembly this year, and I'm still wrapping my mind around all of it, but I think it's been generally a positive for behavioral health. There is one of the things for the coalition's opioid work I've been tracking is that there was the development of an opioid abatement fund for all of the lawsuits that are going to be coming out of the Attorney General's office that will be directing more funding to prevention, treatment, and recovery. One of the things we've been able to do with our existing opioid funding is to make it within the bounds and the guidelines of the funding, but to be able to provide services that address all substances. And so I just think that that funding is going to be an exciting opportunity. There is legislation that passed that are going to allow schools to bill for Medicaid for health services provided by schools. Previously, that was only for if students had an IEP, an individualized education plan, but this new legislation opens the opportunity for schools to increase services or develop school-based clinics. Another big issue that we'll be keeping an eye on is marijuana legalization. And that is a very mixed issue. It comes with expungement for people who had prior drug marijuana charges, which at the coalition we see as a good thing. That people who, you know, have small possession charges sometimes can have a criminal history that impacts their life trajectory in all kinds of ways. And we know that prosecution for marijuana crimes was disproportionately against people of color. So we do see that part as a good part. It will increase funding for substance use treatment. From a prevention angle, it is something that's really important that we consider around prevention, particularly for adolescents and their developing brains. And so using good public health strategies to look at placement and zoning for dispensaries that will develop, making sure they're not near schools, not near treatment centers, helping to minimize or eliminate marketing that can be kind of tailored to kids. You know, Joe the Camel in years gone by was actually a targeted marketing campaign to youth to get kind of brand attachment to a cartoon figure. And so those are all things that we'll be looking at with marijuana legalization.
Hey, Lisa, would you like to discuss that a little bit?
There's two things that are of note. One is the Marcus Alert legislation that requires that CJS and DVHDS, criminal justice and behavioral health come together to create a framework for every locality where law enforcement is only involved in responding to somebody in crisis when necessary. Right now, it oftentimes law enforcement is first on scene and is the entity that does an emergency custody order and then is with the person in crisis through the duration of that episode of care to include transportation. And all of that can be and will continue to be necessary at times. But because there is, we have seen and what we know is that involvement with law enforcement, especially with our people of color, increases use of force, incarcerations, hospitalizations, and death, that the Marcus Alert came to pass to say, to require that all localities create a service response framework that decreases the involvement of law enforcement unless necessary. That is between now and 2026, when all communities are required to have implemented that framework. And that work in partnership with the localities and Region 10's catchment has just started in determining what is the local need in terms of community infrastructure, how do we respond in a way that's respectful to a person who's experiencing an emergency and keeps everybody safe. So that's first, and that one is important and big. There are a few localities, five, if you will, that are piloting the Marcus Alert legislation framework between now, I guess they need to be implemented by December of this year. And there's some funding attached to that for those pilot projects. And I can't speak to the long-term funding around us supporting all localities, but I know there's funding connected to those pilots. The second piece is around the governor's approval for funding towards those STEP Virginia steps. So as you know, as I mentioned, the Department of Behavioral Health is seeking to align a set of standards of practice for services across all 40 CSBs. There are two truths about CSBs. One is that if you've been to one CSB, you've been to one CSB. And two is that CSBs, although are different in culture and personality, and they are most different in services that they're able to provide. And here at Region 10, we've been really lucky to have a lot of local support, a lot of state support, a lot of creativity and good past leadership of the organization that has built a very strong infrastructure, but that's not true across CSBs. And so the department is saying, gosh, I'd like you to all 40 CSBs to have this set of services that look this way for the people who need them. And so currently we're looking at mobile crisis response and regional crisis call centers with the vision that anyone experiencing a psychiatric emergency could call one number and be screened for what's needed in the moment to help the person and to divert hospitalization, and then deploy or connect that person to services and supports to do just that. That'll take years. But the mobile crisis response is sort of a connection to that as one of those services and supports that could be deployed. And then we're going to look at service members, veterans, and families, and how to make sure that we have specialized response for those individual and unique needs to families who are in the military and what everyone is exposed to and what they experience. And then last but not least, looking at peer support and the importance of people who have lived experience and their role in helping other folks on their journey. And so there's funding attached to each of those steps. And over the next period of time, Region 10 will be working with each of our localities to say, here's what we're thinking about doing here, you know, based on this coming from the department, but how does it then meet our needs in the next year or so?
Okay, I had another question come in, and that was asking about how the churches in our communities might be of help. Rebecca, you want to try that first?
Sure. So one way I think that is really, really important is, first I just want to acknowledge that churches can be frontline for behavioral health supports for many people in the community. That social support is critical. And so church leaders, whether it's clergy or other informal church leaders, can all help by making mental health and substance use an actual conversation within their congregations. And so being willing and open to talk about mental health and substance use helps people feel safe seeking help. It helps to reduce stigma related to mental health and substance use. And so opening the conversation is a huge service to your faith community. Region 10 offers a whole lot of free trainings that can be really helpful to congregations. So mental health first aid, there's community resilience initiative, which is about trauma and resilience. We offer overdose reversal trainings. So these are all ways that people can help to build their skills as community helpers or formal faith leaders to know a little bit more about mental health and substance use, how to respond. I would encourage people, you can sign up for our newsletter. Knowing about local services is a huge way, being able to help refer people. And to sign up for the newsletter, you can email me at rebecca.kendall@region10.org, rebecca.kendall@region10. 10 is all spelled out, TEN.org. But that is the main thing I would say that I think is really, really critical, is just that informal and formal leadership really support that conversation around mental health.
I wanted to tell our audience that we will post both Rebecca and Lisa's email address so that you can have access to that. I have another question, and that was regarding the women's program. Lisa, is that, I understand that was closed for a while. Has that reopened yet?
No, if you're talking about the women's residential treatment facility for substance abuse, it has not. Early in the pandemic, when we had multiple challenges, including staffing shortages, we had to combine programs. And so our goal at this point is to open just as soon as we can restaff. And so to you all in the audience, if you know someone who's experienced in substance, I'm just going to do a plug, substance use disorders, interested in working at Region 10, look on our website, because as soon as staffed appropriately, we'll reopen the Women's Center. And I just took a moment of privilege on that.
Thank you, Lisa. Another question I think would be directed toward you is, now I'm going to have to read this. If I saw the chart correctly, it looks like OD rates are higher in Region 10's catchment area than in the state as a whole. This seems surprising. Are there reasons for this?
So, Rebecca, that was your slide. I can speak to substance abuse in our catchment, and then I'll ask Rebecca to speak to that slide. We do have, when we look at our catchment area, we have differing challenges with substance abuse across our catchment, and our highest challenge is in Louisa County. And so I can't speak to the higher than Virginia piece, but I can say that we are seeing one, significant pockets of substance use disorder, and two, highest in Louisa County. Rebecca, what would you add to that?
Well, ditto. I would say, yes, Louisa is consistently has higher rates of overdose. There are very different, I guess, drug profiles for the different counties. In Nelson County, there's more of a methamphetamine problem. So this is the average over the whole catchment area. So if you would look at each of the counties and each of the jurisdictions, some of those are probably under the state average and some of those are probably over the state average. Likewise, you know, different regions around the state are going to be, you know, some would be higher than Region 10 and some would be lower. Louisa really is the focal area for the need for more work around opioid treatment, prevention, recovery.
Okay, thank you. Another question that's come in, and you mentioned that, I think at one point, Lisa, is services for veterans. How do your two organizations interact with, for example, there's an outpatient clinic for veterans here in Charlottesville and Pantop Territory. How does Region 10 interact with those folks?
We make referrals. What we're learning as we're focused on who is our service member veteran and veteran population is that we are we need to do a better job of asking a particular question to identify those who we serve, who are service connected. So I'd say first, I'm not sure that Region 10 in this moment has an accurate number of our service connected individuals, and we're working on that. And then second, what we have in terms of resources is to refer to other places, because we don't have services within Region 10 that are specialized only for service connected individuals. And so there's opportunity for development is what I would say.
Yeah, and I would just add that the safety device distribution that we're doing, the lock boxes and trigger locks, it's part of the larger Lock and Talk campaign, which is a regional suicide prevention campaign. And for the region, veterans are identified as a focus population for suicide prevention efforts. So we have had some contact with the veterans family support unit that have gotten some of the lock boxes and trigger locks, but that is one of the areas regionally that the CSBs are prioritizing veterans.
Thank you, Rebecca. Another question from our audience has to do with the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. They understand that there is some 30-minute wait for the hotline. Is that similar in this area? How do we handle that locally?
I don't know about the 30-minute wait. That seems bad. And so I can, if we're talking about the 988 number, then I'd be interested in knowing more. And so when the, my email goes out, if that person would be willing just to tell me what they know, I'd be interested in that. I'd follow up on that. Locally, what we do currently is, we have a 24/7, phone number that people can call in crisis. And we call back within 10 minutes and we make a decision about whether we need to see them face to face. We do that within 2 hours. What is true is just what I said earlier, which is locally or regionally, if you will, which is 9 CSBs in our geographical area. We will be developing and standing up a regional crisis call center that will respond to be available 24/7 to talk with people who are in crisis and respond as necessary. Excuse me. And the goal is over time that all the other numbers, including any warm lines and the 988 number, will port into this crisis call center. And so then the response is local, if you will.
Thank you, Lisa. I want to clarify something I said before when I mentioned that your email addresses would be posted. They will be on the thank you note that Senior Statesman sends to each of our audience. So you'll have it in the mail. We're pretty much out of time. I wanted to thank both Lisa and Rebecca for taking their time. I know that there are busy folks, particularly in this time, and it really is important that you're able to do that and share time with us. And also just simply to thank you for the services that you each and all of the folks who work with you provide to our community. It's really substantial and kind of amazing. So thank you again, folks. And thank you to the audience for taking the time to tune in. I do want to mention that today's program will be available, is videoed, has been videoed, and will be available probably as early as tomorrow morning on our website. And I hope you'll take time and consider joining SSV. We are a remarkable value at only $20 annually a year. So think about that, if you will, please. And I want to tell you about next month's program, which will be May 12th, Wednesday, May 12th. And it will be our annual General Assembly wrap-up. This is one of our big programs of the year, and we always invite all of our area legislators, that is to say, Virginia state legislators, and we get any number of responses, but this year we're really hitting on all the cylinders. We have four of our local delegates have said positive that they will be there, and one of our state senators. So we hope that you will tune in on that. And again, thanks everybody. As always, stay tuned and stay safe, and good day. Bye-bye.